South Africa, and a few places, I think, in Europe. But generally speaking, it is very much a South African brand, which we know, but it's not necessarily as globalized as you might imagine. So enjoy your Nando's while you can, really. Maybe it's something you could export into the rest of Europe in some way. Anyway, we're live actually, so we may as well get on with it. We are so this
We
is
weren't
episode.
live when you said all of that, when I came back to the
No. Certain things I'm prepared not to share on your behalf, Adam. So you can be rest assured on
about
that
me.
side. No, but we are live. So welcome everyone. This is episode 24 of Recruiting Brain Food live on air. So for those of you who are new to the show, what we do this every week. And essentially it is a live talk show where we review the content that was sent in the Recruiting Brain Food newsletter last week. Also of the amazing things we were talking about in the Recruiting Brain Food Facebook group. And hopefully we'll be able to talk about a focus topic as well, and get some intelligent people on screen to help us work out what the topic of the day really is. My name is Hung Lee. I'm your host, and I'm joined as ever by my co-pilot and chief promoter, Adam Gordon. Adam, how are you, sir?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. I'm not sure I'm officially, well, I am officially chief promoter, but I'm not sure I'm actually the number one promoter anymore because there's other people who probably do more than I do now.
You know what? That's true. And then the reason why I know that's true is because we're recording it. I'm building something basically in the background, which records things like who is promoting Brain Food, who's submitting content, who's creating content that's featured regularly, and all of that will be revealed probably in the September. But it's essentially going to be our way of basically saying thank you to the community who have not only read Brain Food and consumed it, but have actually come in and they conspicuously supported it, often without prompting from me. But yeah, you're up there, mate.
I'm sure I'm in the top five, probably.
You're not number one. I have to say, you have dropped a little bit, so you need to step up your game. But you're definitely up there because of your historical record. you've gone
It's
on
about the
past glories.
cumulative points. So this is what we say when you're measuring engagement, you got to work out, do you measure points over time and keep measuring them as the points accumulate? Or do you apply a regressive scoring model whereby the points start to go back down again after periods of inactivity? So I favor the cumulative approach personally.
Yeah, for us it's cumulative as well, primarily because we didn't want to overcomplicate it with too much maths. And also we don't want to create this sort of like negative incentive, if that makes any sense. You know, we don't want people to feel terrible that their score is going down. Your score's
Gonna
always
get
going to go.
relegated, mate.
Yeah, your score's always going to go up. Don't worry about that. But it may be that, you know, some of the people overtake you. And do you want to do something about that? Then there's obviously stuff you can do. So it's going to be a bit of fun. It's going to be a little bit gamified. I hope at one point it's going to translate into something that will actually be economically valuable for the contributors. Because we do want to create a bit of a currency in there, like a literal brain food currency. That people can earn and spend, and hopefully it will result in material return for the people who have just been these wonderful supporters of the newsletter, you know.
So is it going to be like a kind of cryptocurrency, or is it just hung points or hung points
Nah,
as well?
it'll be hung points, mate. I mean, cryptocurrency is just too much. Simply because, again, I mean, I don't know that much about sort of blockchain. I know a little bit about it, but at the end of the day, you don't want to build a blockchain unless you really have to. And I'm not going to do that. I'm simply going to score people who do one of four things. So number one, we score people for creating. So if you created content and we feature it, you know what? That's X amount of points. Because
Great.
well done to the community. You've created something amazing. Number two, if you've submitted content, so you sent me something and said, "Hey, Hung, that's cool. Put it in the thing," and I put it in. Thank you very much for helping me crowdsource that. You get some
That's
points.
Dennis will be right up there
Dennis
for
will be
that. Yeah.
right up there. So Irina will be one of the creators. Dennis
Yeah.
will be the submitter, promoter. So someone like yourself will be up there. You know, you just go and promote the thing without solicitation. Amazing. Give you points for that. and donate it. So you remember I ran a tree planting campaign for my birthday. Yes. I really want to push that because I think, you know, everyone can plant a tree and everyone can contribute to planting trees. And I did think that, you know, with 15,000 subscribers of Brain Food, if everyone just planted 10 trees, that's 150,000 trees. You know, quite a significant forest, really. So I want to promote people who did that. So there was about 300 people that did actually contribute. They get a bunch of points, and I want that to be prominent as well, so that people can then think about, hey, listen, actually, can we go and promote this and do some social good? We're all on the same planet. Yeah, it is, but there's certain things are going to be higher than others. But yeah, you'll see the score over time. You'll also see other people's scores, and you'll see a profile as well. So hopefully people who are prominent supporters of Brain Food will also find themselves being quite visible in this community. So if, you know, they're interested in speaking gigs, for instance, or job opportunities or whatever, you know, they just want more eyeballs to them, then, you know, maybe I can help them do that. So yeah, that's going to be released hopefully in September. I think it's going to be awesome. And yeah, it's our way of thanking the community for being so great. Anyway, that's my little project. What's happening with your little project? So you got a tiny project of like raising money, don't you, Adam? Yeah. Have you sorted that yet or what?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it all went live to the public on Crowdcube on Tuesday. So we're now 3 days in, we're at 216 grand or something on there, plus 200 grand or so outside. So about 75 to go, something like that, and then we'll shut it. So we'll shut it at 500,000 raised. We won't take more than that.
So I love the way you just went casual when you're describing the numbers there, as if that was always going to happen, right? How obviously it's a successful raise, so congratulations on that. But honestly speaking, how confident were you when you pushed it that to think that you could get to that number with what looks like, you know, the ease that you've actually achieved it?
Completely confident, and I can tell you why. Because we did a really good warm up campaign. I'd like to actually do some. I'm gonna talk to people about this. I'm gonna do some sort of a show about this or a white paper or something about how do you go about doing this. The first thing you have to do is you go and you ask 50 people. If we were selling like some shares in Candidate ID, do you think people would buy it? If more than 20 people say yes, then go on to the next phase. Next phase is put together a landing page with all the information you need that people are going to need to decide whether or not they would indicatively tell you, would I do it or would I not? And maybe give them three categories of, you know, amounts of money and find and add that all up, send it out to everybody you know, add it all up. And if you're going to get X amount and you're confident you're going to get X amount, then go on to Crowdcube or somewhere, put in an amount of money that you think you're going to get from the people you already know, and then do that. And then other people, the Crowdcube crowd looks at it, goes, that's successful, I'm going to get involved. If we put £500,000 on Crowdcube, I would be cacking myself right now if we'd said that's how much we want to raise from Crowdcube. But I did know there were several other conversations offline with people that were going to be putting in one case, 100 grand, in a couple of other cases, pretty large amounts. So I kind of knew that we would be all right.
Right. You know what? You've just described how to raise funds there. And that actually contrasts quite significantly with my failed campaign to raise, 150 grand for the trees. Because I only did about 2 grand in the end. But the reason why is because I did no prep. And I did none of that pre-market. It's called pre-marketing in startup world, where you basically tap up the people who you want to commit, but you ask them a question, a soft question: would you do it if I did it? Yeah. So that creates a bit of pre-marketing for you. That's actually a really good way to recruit people, by the way, or to test employer brand, or to do anything. If you're going to push an asset out there, if you do a bit of pre-marketing, it's actually a very clever way of getting the message out there, rather than just say, hey, do you want the job? Ask them about the job.
It's almost like nurture and what you would do with a talent pipeline.
Exactly, it's the same
pattern. I kind of like the idea.
Yeah, it's literally the same pattern. Fundraising, charity donations, getting people to apply to your jobs. It's all about trying to firstly establish whether you've got so you do some market intelligence, but the pre-marketing at the same time. So that's a singular thing to do.
Yes.
There was a middle part which you talked about, which was you refine the number. So you get the commitment down to a number, yeah. Not just a yes, yeah. But you granularize the commitment.
Validate what success is likely to be.
Yep. And then when you do go public, you're already 50% of the way there, or you've got at least, you're already 50% out of the door, so you know you're going to close it. And you don't have a ridiculously massive number that people get intimidated by. Because psychologically, when people see a huge number, they shy off it. If they don't think it's going to reach, no one wants to be associated with it, which is what happened with my tree campaign, plant a forest for brain food, right? I said, look, let's do 150 grand. No, I did two. It was a catastrophic failure. But I recovered from it simply because, you know, there's 2,000 trees planted that wasn't going to be planted. So I'm happy with that. But it was a big learn. It was a big learn with regards to how to do it in future. Pre-market, absolutely essential, and a sensible number. Because people get intimidated by the size, you know, we don't want to use that joke, do we? But people do get intimidated by the size. Anyway, here's another little factoid for you before we get into this. The number which converts most people when you set an online game or a test is, I think, 80%. So in other words, if you set a test for someone and say, oh, 80% of the people who try this test fail it, that actually gets you the most attempts when you say 80% fail. Why? Because the fail rate is high enough for people to take it on and not feel crushed egotistically if they also fail, because they can say, hey, 80% of the people try this also fail. Yeah. But it's also 20% is also a big enough sort of percent for people to think, yeah, maybe I'm one of the upper quartile. Maybe I can give it a shot. So it's much more effective than, say, 100% fail, 99% fail. No one does 99% fail because it's guaranteed not to happen. If you do 1% fail, it doesn't teach anything. So 80% magic number. Anyway, let's talk about brain food. Have you had time to read Recruiting Brain Food, or are you going to improv it again? This time as you did last time?
No, I've read it. It was 2 weeks ago that I improved it. Listen, just before I go on to that, let me really quickly say one thing, which is a recommendation for the weekend if anybody gets the opportunity, especially if you're in HR or in-house talent acquisition. I think people in internal recruitment are a little bit snooty about what's happening in recruitment agencies, and they think that they're way ahead and a lot of different things.
Oh, a little bit snooty. In-house are massively snooty, mate.
That's true. And in a lot of ways, I think that they've got reason to be. However, go and listen. If you get the chance, go and listen to the interview that I did. It'll be on the Candidate ID website, I guess, YouTube channel. I did a webinar with Ryan from Odroo.
Oh yeah, good lad.
Yesterday,
mm-hmm.
That guy is absolutely awesome. What they're doing at Odroo is awesome, and the statistics that they have got around the best way to use video in recruitment is just brilliant. It's the interview I did with him is absolutely rammed with tips, but the best one for me, the very best one. Not that this means don't watch it, because there's loads of others, but the best one, if you're sending somebody a video, a personalized video, like a 30-second video, say, hey, it's Adam here. I want to talk to you about a job opportunity because I can see that you've got this skill and this skill and this skill. You'd be perfect for, and then tell them about the job. Just get a bit of paper, write on it, high hung at the very beginning, right? The person knows it's directed at them. The person knows it is, tailored. The message is going to be tailored. They're going to be much, much more likely to watch it. 78% higher engagement rates when you do that alone. High hung.
I was going to ask the question, what was the engagement rate if you did that? And of course, you're going to click on it if you saw a handwritten message of that type. So I've just shared the YouTube there with in the chat stream there. This is with Adam and Ryan McCabe. Spoiler alert, it might just be too Scottish for people there. It's very Scottish kind of video there. But you can go and watch it. Both good guys. And also link in with Ryan over there as well. He is a diamond geezer, I would describe him as. So
one other thing he told me, which I hadn't appreciated, they will not sell Odro to a talent acquisition team. I actually told him that if I was a talent acquisition leader, I would probably try and buy Odro on the basis that I just wanted their update content on how to use video better because it's so brilliant. They had Tesla contact them 2 months ago. They said, sorry, we're not going to serve you with our technology.
So only agency, that's the only focus. Wow. Yep. Why? Yep.
Because it was an agency who recommended to Tesla that they use Odro, and the agents and Tesla then made contact, and they basically said, "I'm sorry, we're not going to help you to do a better job than the agency that we work with. They're our customer."
Got it.
They backed a horse. They backed a horse, and their horse is the agency. But so this is absolutely why you might not, if you're an internal talent acquisition. I spend most of my time with internal teams. Why you might not have come across Odro very much, because all they do is for agencies, but their content is among the best in recruitment, whether you're in-house or you're in agency.
Yeah. You know what? And I've got no horse to back on this because I'm not in any way commercially involved with Odro, but I think they're going to win it simply because of the personalities involved. I love what they're doing. And like you say, the singular focus is actually one of the reasons why you succeed. You know, it's very easy to say yes to business that comes at you. But one of the very clear rules of business is that you've got to understand your market and who your customer is and service that.
They are really deep on expertise. They are literally helping recruitment agencies to be better and make more money and be better at their jobs. And they are absolutely awesome. They are really, really brilliant. One other thing that I find really funny is they white label Odro for every agency they work with. And they've had some feedback from organizations over the last like 6 months or so, which is, so, you know, how do you feel about all the increased competition that you're getting? Because, you know, this company, they're all building their own. And he's like, they're all Odro.
That's great.
Odro. It's the Honda model.
You've reminded me I need to go and catch up with him because I haven't spoke to Ryan. Ryan, if you're watching this, hello. I haven't seen him for a little while, so I'd love to catch up. But I know he's doing great stuff, so he's going to be super busy. But next time I'm in Glasgow, I'm going to come and have a chat with those guys. Yeah. Anyway, amazing stuff. So back to Brain Food. Last week, what was in the newsletter that you thought was interesting, man?
Well, I think that you thought the information from Applied that was tracking diversity metrics on UK job sites was interesting.
And
I looked at it and it gave each job site a score for how diverse or otherwise the applicants were coming through. But it did say pretty clearly, this is really indicative rather than, and I just wonder whether an indicative based on the information that they're getting is actually fair, because it's not a true reflection on what's happening.
Yeah,
and also, I don't understand how they're doing that, because people don't select "I'm a man or a woman" when they're or their ethnicity or whatever when they apply for a job.
No, but they do on their site. So what they've done with Applied is essentially they've checked out their sources of candidates. Applied is an assessment tool, by the way. You should check it out. And they've checked their sources, so how many people have come from this website, and they've got the ethnicity and diversity data, and then they've then extrapolated that to figure out, okay, we've got 100 people coming from the University of Sussex job board, and they've all given this diversity data. We can broadly use that as a sample to then, when they talk about indicative, put a guess as to what sort of level of diversity, what the component is within that job board. So none of the job boards have D&I data. That's definitely true. Should they capture it? It's debatable whether they should or shouldn't. But Applied do have some, and they're basically inferring it back from there. So, write to question methodology. Anybody want to check it out, they can click on that link I've just shared. I think it's worthwhile exercise to review it. Simply because it does give you some indication. If, for instance, there is a job board out there that seems to be dominated, let's say, ethnic minorities, let's say, and you want to diversify your pipeline, that may be on ethnicity, that may be one clear place we can go and investigate. So yeah. Possibly a useful tool. Okay.
Well, it is all UK as well. That's one.
It is indeed. It is indeed, yeah.
Okay, fine. The next one I thought was really interesting was Brendan Brown from LinkedIn.
Yeah, of course.
LinkedIn. Mm. And he shared publicly his checklist for the intake meeting.
Yeah.
So how should you run that meeting with the hiring manager, and what information do you need to get? What sort of coaching do you need to do with that hiring manager? You need to confirm that they understand that they can't put together a list of 50 things and expect that all to happen. And so I find that quite interesting. I feel like in a lot of cases, recruitment is done in too much of an individual way. So a recruiter's personality maybe comes through a little bit too much in some ways, and their way of doing things is not standardized quite enough. So checklists like this and the kind of a format and a model for recruitment, I think is pretty useful. But one thing that I wanted to add, and I was reading it going, I hope he says it. And he didn't say it, is get your phone out, tell the hiring manager in advance that you're going to get your phone out and you're going to ask the hiring manager 3 questions, and you're going to video them, and you're going to ask them, you know, how do you motivate your team? What are the coolest things your team's got coming up that they're working on? And what do you think the top skills are that somebody needs to get ahead in that, you know, whatever your job area is? Every single time you go into an intake meeting, come out with 3 short videos, and you just build content.
You know what? That's just genius. And I'm surprised that actually no one does that. That's a revelation for me, because I read the Brendan's post. I thought, yeah, it was kind of fairly standard. But actually, you could easily convert that into a content creation thing by literally whipping out your mobile phone and recording him as he goes. And that's actually the sort of authentic content that the candidates are really interested to hear from. They don't want to hear, we know they don't want to hear from marketing. We know they don't want to hear the recruiter spiel, but they do want to hear from the hiring manager, and they do want to hear from their potential future peer group. I mean, so that's almost like a basic, hopefully it becomes a mandatory thing going forward. But I don't know too many people that actually do that in that systematic way, you know? So yeah, great tip.
Yeah. Okay. So back to one of my least favorite subjects, which is Instagram. There's a checklist. I think was it? Is this a Dennis contribution?
It's Dennis again. Yeah.
How to search and find and engage on Instagram. So what I'm really interested to know a little bit more about this OSINT community and I don't know the background of it, but I can see that a lot of interesting things are coming from this.
OSINT is basically simply open source intelligence. That's what it stands for. And the reason why it's interesting is because it's usually coming from people. It started off in the kind of cybersecurity kind of community. And it's all about trying to verify people, identify information, validate things that are true or not. And of course, that's got relevance in terms of their techniques to recruiting. So recruitment has really jumped onto the OSINT techniques. And the main difference between this and standard sourcing is just that it goes a little bit deeper. It goes a little bit deeper than the standard graphical interface. So one of the things that I think most recruiters don't ever get beyond is the fact that they're in some sort of UI. There's a search box, and they know how to search it. They know how to do Boolean, but it's all inputted within this graphical user interface. People in the OSINT community know how to get behind that. They kind of know how to work at the URL level, if you like, to hack around with that. And also understand that there's a lot more information than that which is published online. So there's probably the king of all of the OSINT community is probably Bellingcat. I don't know whether you know this guy. But he's an investigative journalist, and he does all kinds of stuff like just investigate government cover-ups and stuff like this. And it's a little bit shrouded in gray area stuff. And, you know, is he a plant at the end of the day? Is he himself a part of the disinformation universe? Who knows? But at the end of the day, there's no question there's some super sophisticated skills there that can be used for candidate identification. But we're also running slap back into all kinds of privacy issues, ethical issues, and all the rest of it. So anyway, I've just shared with you a couple of links there. Austin Curious, that's how you search Instagram. Product you typically can't search. With these techniques, you can. So there you go.
So on the same theme, hooray, we can search Facebook again with Searchbook.
Right. Indeed. Also from the Austin community again, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, what I want to talk about here is not necessarily the technique, but the fact that Facebook has kind of pivoted towards privacy. Mm-hmm. This has really been quite damaging to a lot of recruiters who are at that technical sourcing level, because of course, Facebook is a much bigger database than LinkedIn. LinkedIn is 500, maximum 500 million users, but also locked into certain demographics. 500 million sort of users, probably really about 200 million when you think about who's truly active, and most of them white collar workers in English speaking, in the English speaking world. Whereas Facebook, we're into the billions here. Two billion people are on Facebook. Yes, a certain amount of fakes, but you can imagine, I don't know anybody that hasn't got or had a Facebook account. That isn't, you know, an older person, 60s and above. We've all had an account. I know some people have deleted an account, but we've all been there. So that's an information trail. If you're a recruiter, you should know how to search it. And that last link I've shared basically gives you a workaround on the decline of graph search, which was the source of way of searching Facebook. But I think you've got to use Firefox instead of Chrome on this, but there's all kinds of weird things you can do, but it might open up that 2 billion population for you to potentially do some recruitment work. So there you go.
Yep. I think it's, you've got to use it in Chrome rather than Firefox.
Is that right? Okay. Yeah. Fair play.
So yeah, you're absolutely right about Facebook. It's vital. And an example would be, we have a new customer, which is one of the UK's biggest dental businesses, and you know, there's 87,000 dentists across Europe, and the number of them that are on Facebook it dwarfs the number of them that are on LinkedIn.
Right.
The other thing is, the average Facebook user is on Facebook 35 minutes a day. The average LinkedIn user is on LinkedIn 17 minutes a month.
Yep.
Not that much opportunity to capture the attention.
Yep. I think you've got to be multi-channel. If you're recruiting right now, LinkedIn might be a very good way to find your white-collar worker. But you also need to have some sort of strategy on Facebook, whether it's searching it, which a lot of sources do, or you could do ads on it. I mean, it's one of the cheapest ways in which you could actually promote your brand by Facebook ads, custom audience and all that type of stuff. And in fact, in the recruiting animal sort of recruitment, recruiters online, which, you know, I think after recruiting Brain Food, Facebook group is the best sort of Facebook group on around. But there was a guy who basically shared some know-how on how to use Facebook ads for recruitment. And he said, actually, don't do a call to action. Definitely don't do push jobs. Definitely don't ask people to apply. Just get your brand out there. And if your brand is ubiquitous enough, he's saying that basically that's going to help you convert when you do have to do the outreach. So it's a combination of brand building and then outreaching, maybe from LinkedIn again or whatever. But it's like you just keep pumping it out there. It's very cheap. It's very cost effective, should I say. Bloody Brain Food should be doing it. I don't know whether they're kind of the idea doing it, but we need to get started on some Facebook ads, I think.
Listen, two actually quick other things about that. We were talking about programmatic last week. After the show, I spoke to the chief marketing officer of a global recruitment company, and I mentioned to her about what we were talking about, and asked about their approach around programmatic, and it was entirely different to anything we talked about on the show. It was Facebook was in the middle of a lot of it. But it was about lookalike. It was about using all the data, Cambridge Analytical style, and it was about pure. It was about pure lookalikes. Anybody, any IP addresses that have been to their website, been looking at their content and stuff like that. It was about identifying the lookalikes, and that's their. And they've built their own with a company in London. They built their own ad serving program effectively, and it sounded like something else that we need to talk about on here. But
you know what? On that note, this is why I'm kind of conflicted with Cambridge Analytica generally, and I'm kind of having disputes online with my friends who obviously are appalled at Cambridge Analytica's antics, which have definitely been heavily influential in number of political. I mean, they're political consultancy almost, where you know they're coming in there and they're really affecting electoral results in different ways. But they're actually, most of the time, they're just doing lookalike audiences. It's nothing that different, I don't think, from how a brand might build. You know, if a brand was doing this on a commercial level, you'd applaud them and say, hey, listen, they're actually doing a great job of identifying the sort of audiences that want to buy that product. And the real problem I think we have with stuff like Facebook lookalike audiences is that maybe we're surfacing up actually the ugly realities that have always been there. You know, that people do have certain views that may actually conflict very much with what you want the world to be. So this company is
on a mission to phase down basically all job adverts on job boards over the next 4 years. In 4 years' time, they think their job board spend will be zero. Right. And it's all about lookalike profiles. So you find the IP address, lookalike profiles using Google and Facebook mainly. And I'm like, this is what she was talking about is very different to anything we talked about last week.
We should get her on the show. I mean, one of the things, because programmatic was all about across different platforms anyway. And one of the things I definitely want to do is look at paid social. Which is what we're talking about here. You know, the idea of identifying audiences and giving them the content that's likely to interest them. We should definitely do that for positive stuff, particularly if you've got a brand that's worth it.
They've built, I'll just tell you the company they built this with. I'm going to share it in here, actually. In fact, I'm not. Yes. It's a company called iProspect, but other thing I was just going to say about that is, did you watch The Great Hack on Netflix?
I haven't, and I'm sorry I haven't done that. Obviously, I need to do so. Give me the quick pressy on that. What's so good about it?
Well, I mean, it's an expose on what Cambridge Analytica did. It's Brittany Kaiser, who was their business development director, has effectively just laid it all out, exactly what they were doing. And she's really thrown Alexander Nix under the bus a big way. There's some reveal moments where she basically her old calendar, and within the calendar there's links to things that she's been able to go and find, and she effectively on the show is able to show that they did not delete 5,000 data points on 78 million US people. Right, when they were told they were to delete it, and they said they had deleted it and they hadn't. It's well worth watching. It's about an hour and a half, and it's kind of, you know, sort of cringe. There's a lot of cringe moments in it, but it's quite enlightening.
What have you taken away from that?
That Alexander Nix was an incredibly smart guy. I really admire him, although also probably evil, and I just don't know which of those two comes over the most. But smart, charming, cool, funny, and probably evil. Yep, all of those things.
Yep. I think that's right. We're in a world where there's a small number of people that just understand how to push information through the internet, and they've got disproportionate power and influence over how we think and feel. And the way I feel about this is, yes, that can be used for good or evil. Unfortunately, we've seen some conspicuous people who I would say, probably not. They're not good guys. But I'm waiting to see, is there a good guy that can step up to do this? But maybe this type of manipulation is inherently bad. You know, it doesn't matter whether you've got positive values or what I think are positive values. If you're prepared to manipulate people at scale, you know, what does that mean? Does that sort of negate any positive kind of views that you might have about humanity?
The guy is like charming, funny, like doing it in plain, almost doing it in plain sight, like in restaurants, talking openly about what he's been doing, how he basically he made Brexit happen, kind of like, oh, but we don't talk about that. Yeah, I'm pretty sure he's eaten in Oxford, something like that, and like literal definition of a bounder.
Yeah, yeah,
to the biggest possible scale.
Yeah, they're just having a laugh. I mean, there's a certain tier of people that, you know, they're what, seeing the world as their playground. And
what can I get away with?
Yeah, and again, you know, half of me thinks they're just exploiting a weak system. And we've got to find a way to strengthen the system, and a lot of it is on us. I know that a lot of people like to blame the social media companies for it, and you know, there's all this narrative about Zuckerberg being the most evil person on the planet, and I'm thinking, you know what, he's a 35-year-old kid who's in an unprecedented position of creating a company which he never intended to create, and now he's sitting in charge of it. How is he supposed to behave? We don't know. You know, I think he's doing his best, is my view. But at the same time, he's created a way in which people can communicate, which we've never seen before. And I think this can be used for good or ill. Quite right, Jacek. Big government, bad app.
A lot of uncharted territory in this.
Yeah.
I do think if you watch it, it fills in. You watch this show, it fills in a couple of blanks. It's pretty good.
I'm gonna watch it. That's the next thing I'm gonna do after this show. All right. What else is interesting before we get into the meat of this, Adam?
Yeah. I really admire HubSpot, and they've made a lot of success from their free CRM. They've got about 80 times more. There's 80 times more HubSpot users than there are Marketo users, which I think is the number two in mainstream marketing automation. And right enough, it is made for like mom and pop shops. It's not made for big business. So it would have a lot more. It's made for small organizations. But now they've launched free email tools as well. And that's big inspiration for me. And that's why I'm launching a free CRM and email tools.
Yeah. Are you launching free stuff as well?
Yep. Free CRM and email tools end of this month.
Amazing. We'll definitely look to check that out. I mean, by the way, HubSpot, they initially came under my radar way back when they had the product called Sidekick. I don't know whether you're aware of this.
Yeah, yeah.
But they bought Sidekick, which is a brilliant kind of just an email tracker, you know. But that had one of the best viral mechanisms of distribution I've ever seen, free, as long as you added 10 people or invited 10 people to use it. And I'm pleased that they're bringing this back. At least the concept of free stuff. So what HubSpot have done, by the way, on this is simply create an ability for you to create marketing emails, decent templates, and you send 2,000 a month on their free CRM. And if you're sensible with it, not spamming people, it probably is a positive thing. All right, cool.
The main reason they've done it? The main reason they've done it is because the CRM bit is not that life-changing. The bit that's the life-changing bit is their marketing automation bit. That's the life-changing bit. That's the bit that every company gets the real, real value from. So just one more. The order of hiring. So when you're building a business, which jobs should you hire in which order? Mm. I've got to be honest, I can't remember who wrote it. I looked at it and thought it was really interesting. It's going to be different in different companies, but I can see the logic behind what they were putting together there.
Yeah, this is basically by a guy called Jason Lemkin, and he's writing basically from a classic startup scale up type of scenario. Like, who do you hire first if you've got 5 million quid and no one else? And there's an order there, which he, according to him, basically he's saying you should hire the VP of marketing first, then the VP of sales, then the VP of customer success, then the VP of product, because presumably as a CEO, you are the VP of product. And only then do you hire the VP of engineering, which I actually surprised the hell out of me.
But presumably I also thought he must be meaning that he also must be meaning that he is bringing in, one of the co-founders is also a CTO. I assume it must be that.
I didn't read that. I mean, I assumed basically it was basically because, maybe he's already thinking the CTO is in place. But I was thinking, right, maybe you can get away with like an off the shelf or offshore product up until that time, until you need to re-engineer it. But maybe I'm wrong on that. But check it out.
He's the guy that founded DocuSign. Is that right, Jason Lemkin?
I'm not sure. It might have been.
And you built DocuSign and sold it to somebody like Oracle. Oh, EchoSign. That's it. Yeah.
So he's a
smart guy. I read him. I read some of what he says on that site where you ask questions. Quora. I follow him on Quora and read quite a lot of what he says. And he's a smart guy. He's also the guy behind Sastr.
Is he really?
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
He's the founder of Sastr.
And
yeah, very, very smart, guy. And I thought the order was pretty much right. VP of marketing would be the first hire, because a lot of what they do, as far as I'm concerned, everything is marketing. Basically, the way you price your product, the way you do pretty much everything is marketing. So,
what about the complete absence of the chief people person there, or a head of recruitment of some type? Because I thought that was one of the reasons why I put it into Brain Food. Because, is it really that irrelevant? Can the CEO get away with not having this person in? Or actually, have we still got a PR problem? And do we need to get this message out that you probably need a VP of some sort of recruitment function way in advance of that? Because it's going to help you hire all of those other people.
I think when you've got like eight people, and I don't think that was the hiring of the senior team. I think what he was saying there was literally, this is the order for the hiring of the team. He wasn't, because he was talking about ARR going up, wasn't he?
Yeah, he's talking about how much your money's making and when do you need these people. So I reckon he's missed out on that, simply because it's a hidden function, and we've got a PR problem. You know, we with these types of businesses, they need to know none of those people get hired unless you do have a really good direct hiring function. You can't do all of that with headhunters. If you try to hire a senior exec team purely from headhunters, you're not going to get very far, I think.
Well, you're also not going to get founded as much as he did. You're not going to get funded in the same way that he got funded if you don't already have pretty much the names written on the list of who you're going to hire. You call it gentleman's agreement that they are coming on board as soon as the money's in the bank.
So maybe he's thinking on those lines as well. He's already walking in with a network of people he needs to staff that up in. So there's an additional bit of context there. All right, cool. Listen, we're nattering on, but we've got a topic of conversation to have, which is HR conferencing versus HR reality. And this idea came from a blog post that Robin Schooling wrote. I don't know whether anybody had a chance to read it, but it's a really funny blog post. And I need to share that into a future Brain Food. And I wanted to get Robin on the show, actually, but she wasn't able to do it. But basically, this is the idea that we all go to conferences. They're all amazing. But oftentimes, the stuff that we hear is just not connected with the reality, the mundane operation reality of what goes on in HR and TA. And why is that? You know, do we suffer a little bit from not having a realistic topic set within these conferences, and is this a problem?
My perspective on that is that if you have got imagination and you've got the ability to achieve influence, you can go and listen to something happening that somebody's talking about at a conference, and you can get back to your office and embed it. If you've not got very much influence and you don't have very much imagination, or you're working at a company that really you need to get the hell out of it, then that's a different thing. But really looking forward to finding out what Katrina's got to say about this subject.
I do need to bring Katrina on as well, because she's another one of these people that's got a flight to catch. So let me just grab hold of Katrina Hutchison O'Neill and see whether we can get her on screen. I think she's in Florida right now. So I'm not sure whether we're going to have a Renee moment. There we go.
Hey.
How are you doing, Katrina?
At least she's wearing a top, unlike Rennie was.
I'm wearing two tops. I'm double topping it. I thought swimwear was not sufficient.
I can see palm trees and I can see what looks like reasonably sunny weather over there, Katrina. So
it's pretty decent.
Whereabouts are you?
So I'm in Orlando because we're flying back out of here, but we've been down the coast in Naples for a few weeks.
Amazing.
So I literally left the day after Wreckfest. Came straight out here, and I've been here since Wreckfest.
So is this a massive holiday? Have you been? Is it a vacation of some? Is it working as well, or what?
Working, but you always have to be working when it's your own gaff, right? I've been working, but we made the smart move of putting the kids into an American summer camp. Been there during the day, which has been an interesting experience, learning a bit more about your kids from how they got on at summer camp. But yeah, it's been really good. So they've been doing that. I've been working in the mornings and then vacay the rest of the time. It's pretty good.
Amazing. I love this style of work. Hopefully we're moving much more towards that. Get away from the four walls in the office. What is the point in all of this, you know? For people who don't know, Katrina, you are a very experienced person working in resourcing. You've been a head of talent at big companies. You've worked also for recruitment tech companies also. Now you set up your own recruiting and HR consultancy type of business. But you seem to be the perfect person to have a chat with specifically about this topic of the gap between what's said and what's done. Particularly when it comes to the conference side of it. So I wonder whether you could share your thoughts on that. I mean, do you think there's a little bit too much unreality that's on the stage when we go to a decent conference?
Yeah, well, this was literally in a fit of irony, right? This was literally what I spoke about at Wreckfest. Whole conversation at Wreckfest was specifically on, is TA like sex? With the concept being everybody thinks everybody's doing it better and getting more because you come to the conferences and you hear about all of these fancy toys that everybody else has and then you're really worried that you've not got them. So that's literally what I was talking about. And the number of people that came up to me afterwards to say that they were so relieved because they do come to those conferences and they hear people talking about whether it's initiatives or products or new approaches that they're trying out, and it seems so far removed from what they're having to struggle with day to day, which, let's be honest, for 95% of recruiters is much more about how do I just get enough money to be able to advertise my vacancies? How do I convince the business to use social more whenever they're nervous about that? How do I even get workforce planning to a degree that I've got some concept of what vacancies I'm going to have in 3 months from now? That's the reality of what people are struggling with. And that resonates with me from being in-house working for most of my career. Even when you're working in companies where you've got a good budget and you're able to work at a more strategic level, you're still grappling with those basic things every day.
I hadn't actually realized that was the topic of your talk, Katrina.
I forgive you because you were in a different stage.
I was tunnel vision, so I couldn't see it. But that's actually fascinating. I definitely want to rewatch that if it was ever videoed. Why do you think that is? I mean, so obviously there's a gap, and we kind of understand we need to tell the great stories and so on. But have we gone too far the other way in the sense of, you know, everyone is trying to embellish too much? And it's almost like an Instagram version of reality, isn't it? Everyone's got their perfect version. Whereas actually there's a lot of warts underneath all of that.
It's like watching Love Island. like not everybody looks like that in the real life.
Exactly. Well, do you know, I think there needs to be a bit of a balance of the two, right? Anything that you go to, if you go to a conference, you want to be inspired. You want to hear some stuff that challenges you, particularly if they're case studies of where people have actually implemented something. You want to hear the warts and all. But I do think that those conferences that you go to where it's only about that, it's only about the future innovation piece, and they miss some of the content around the basics, that can be too big a gap for most people. I actually find myself at most of the conferences I talk, I'm literally being asked to talk much more about, can you tell people, how do you write a business case? How do you make a start on doing demand planning and workforce planning? I know you mentioned it earlier, Adam, but how do you have a proper contracting conversation with a hiring manager? Those are the types of conversations that people are wanting to have. And if I think back, and I know, Hung, one that you and I did together back in Australia, in Wreckfest, Australia last year, that's exactly what I was talking about there. I'd say probably 70% of the time that's the type of conversation. But I have been to loads of conferences where you're just not getting that. I don't know, what do you guys think? You probably go to as many conferences as I do.
I think the inspiration is important. So half of me thinks, yes, we need to hear the great stories. Mm-hmm. But I do think it can intimidate people as well as inspire. The worst thing you want to do if you're a delegate at a conference is to walk away thinking, I can't do that. Or it's not happening in my company. Like, that's actually been a negative experience in some respects. So I wonder what you could do. I've got an idea. I'll throw it out at you. Maybe you could do the case studies, but as a condition of you doing a case study, you need to also talk about at least one mistake you made. There should be, and by the way, this is where we've messed up. So you make it a rule. So everybody who's doing the talk on a case study, yes, talk about your case study, but there has to be one slide where you talk about, hey, I've learned this, don't do that if you're doing it again. And then to tell the true story, because I'm sure no one runs a perfectly smooth process in a complicated implementation, but also to give people a sense that actually human beings are involved here, and it's okay to kind of trip up and make a few mistakes here and there.
And I think also remember, whenever somebody's standing up on stage talking about a case study, it's not entirely true. It's probably about 60-70% of the time those people that are talking, they're in a deep expert in one area. There was this, just for a weird analogy, there was a super interesting article last week that was out online about a guy who had this chronic illness, like a debilitating illness, and he was in bed for 12 years, couldn't leave the house. And he wasn't a doctor, didn't have a medical degree, but because he couldn't leave his bed, he researched and discovered his own cure for this incredibly rare condition and invented a surgery to fix his condition and then convinced some doctors to do it. And so he got himself cured, and now Harvard and MIT professors use him to come and talk to their classes about this particular group of conditions because he's the expert. But he's not a doctor, he's not a surgeon, but yet he's the expert on that one little sliver. And I think we've got that in recruitment as well. We've got some amazing, deep, deep, deep experts in particular slivers. And I don't think people should be intimidated by the fact that they know so much. They should look up to them as thought leaders for that area, but not use that as a watermark for where they need to get to themselves.
Mm. Yeah, I think there's a few conditions that need to be in place for somebody to go to a conference, listen to inspirational presentations, and then go and make things happen. And I mentioned two of them, which is if you need to be able to influence people who can understand that filling tomorrow's job is not the only objective. And I think a lot of people in recruitment don't have that. And in fact, I think a lot of people in the world do not have the right skills to be able to go and make change happen. And that's one condition.
Isn't that about seniority though? I mean, you're basically, if you hold that rule, then essentially you're saying only people who've achieved a certain degree of seniority and gravitas internally should attend these conferences.
I don't think it's just about seniority. However, I do remember Kat telling me, I don't know, a year ago or something, that she was able to go and make several things happen in her last salaried job, where other people in the business wouldn't have been able to make it happen.
Right.
I think it's a healthy disrespect for authority, Adam. I think that's been the defining characteristic of my career.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you said that at the time. And I do believe that, I do believe that you actually feel like that. There's like systems of hierarchy that I think too many of us actually bow to. And we maybe shouldn't. We should maybe give them less credence than we do. So that's one thing. I think that we suffer in recruitment from a bit of status anxiety,
right.
And I think a bit of low self-esteem. We don't necessarily think that we are such a vital part of an organization as we really are. And it's not just that. When we're sitting within HR, who has that status anxiety, significant status anxiety, worse than we do, and they've got serious low self-esteem, how do we have to circumnavigate them to make important things happen? So I don't believe that resourcing should sit within HR for a start, personally. I simply don't. So it would certainly get a lot more done in most organizations if it wasn't. So I think that's
a whole separate chat show.
It is. Of course it is.
It is. And you know what? It would be quite interesting to poll the Brain Food audience to see whether HR does in fact sit within HR. Like, what is the recruitment does sit within HR? What is the distribution here? Because I think, you know, generally speaking, I think they are starting to separate. But yeah, some very interesting topics there. Like, what? Why is it that people don't implement what they do learn from a conference? You know, I mean, you go in, you hear a great talk, you want to implement it. You mentioned one thing, you don't have the internal influence. I think that's definitely one issue. But maybe another issue is time. Maybe you don't have the capacity.
It's firefighting.
Or where do you start? Like, for a lot of people, that's the hardest bit of, I want to do that, but it's a huge mountain. Where do I even begin? That can be really difficult. And I don't think we necessarily talk about that bit of the journey enough at conferences. We tend to go in at the point of, we've got some degree of a pilot or an implementation happening. We talk about what was the trigger for making that step or making that innovation, but we don't really talk about what was that first little baby step that started the walk of 1,000 miles. And I think that's really difficult for people, especially if you've never done it before.
You know what, Kat, you're starting to educate me on how to give talks now, because what I need to be doing is to provide, obviously, the talk, the inspirational stuff and that all that type of great things. But I also need to dampen that down with mistakes. This is what happened. But then I also need to give people the first step. Like, if I was to do it again, this is my first step. Give people a how-to guide on what you've just talked about, because you want them to walk away not only feeling inspired, but also feeling confident they can do it, but have a little bit of know-how how to do it. And that's where you could actually have a really good high-impact talk.
So what you just said, I think, fits in nicely with what Ayo has just said on the chat there, which is, a lot of presenters feel they've got to bring their A game to these conferences. So they're probably feeling, I've got to show off here. I've got to give people things that are like really aspirational, rather than what you just said, which is also explain some mistakes you made, or, you know, like things to avoid, rather than just the unattainable kind of standards for things. And Kat, you made a point about, you said about where to begin. We've got a situation where there's never been as much change happening in recruitment as there is today in terms of procedural changes, some of it being forced on us and some of it our own making. Technology change, massively changing kind of workforce and way that people can go about actually earning a living. And there's never been as much stress put on recruitment as there is today. So where to begin is a vital one, but almost every organization I see, I'm not going to quite quote Danny Hodgson, because you'd have to bleep out several of the words, but basically you need to stop doing reactive recruitment. We're firefighting in recruitment. We're working on 40 recs at all times. We can't take on any enhancements to our process or our technology or anything else, because we've got 40 roles to fill right now each.
So
I think there's a double down on that, right? So there's two sides to that. And I've probably used both of them to suit my needs with different stakeholders. One side of that is where you've got the business pushing you to take on new aspects of service delivery within recruitment, or to adopt tools because somebody's friends, cousins, dog's aunt went to university with a person that developed this tool, so they want you to use it, whether or not it fits with your function. Or they want you to take a 20% haircut on your budget. I've been really happy to go back to the table right the way up to CEO level to say, look, absolutely no problem to deliver that, whatever that is. Let's say it's a pound figure. Here's the list of things that you can choose from that we can stop doing that would create the space for us to be able to do that. So that's one side of that. The other side, though, is the argument around if you want to get the investment to put in a new piece of kit or to bring in different skill set to your team or to redesign how your structure and your team works, being able to go in and present that back to the business in terms of outcomes. What I see happening a lot with recruiters, I think it happens across HR a lot as well, is that people talk about it in terms of the feelings and the inputs, as opposed to the, or the HR outcomes, as opposed to the business outcomes. So they talk about it will make our, you know, it'll make our time to offer 20% higher. Who gives a shit, right? It doesn't, like, what does time to offer even really mean? That what the business cares about is how quickly, and Danny will say the same thing, how quickly does somebody get their butt on a seat, and are they there when they need to be there? I think if you can couch it in those two different ways and use it as you need to for that situation, that'll really help you get the investment.
Yeah.
So maybe HR and recruitment generally haven't done themselves a favor by evolving their kind of our own language, you know. We've got our own way of speaking, own terminology. It's very normal when you're in an industry. But that's alien to too many people. And we actually need to go through some sort of translation at the very least when we're having dialogue with different parts of the organization and make sure that we don't sort of drag them into our world that, you know, they've got limited interest in. We've got to go into their world, really.
But if you're a chief technology officer and you want to get even something really basic, like you want to get more investment into your service help desk for the company, you're going to go in and you're going to start talking about the impact that that's going to have in terms of uptime in the organization and how much more productivity the organization's going to get if your team can fix things faster. But if you think about it in recruitment, we don't do it that way. We typically talk about the, using the serve desk analogy, we'll go in and talk about how many cases we'll be able to handle and the time to manage each case, as opposed to the impact of that on the productivity of the organization. It's a bit weird that we just struggle to make that connection.
Mm. Why are we... Go on.
It's interesting chat in the sidebar here. I've been trying to multitask and listen to this and read that. Randy Moore has made a great comment, which is that people on stage are basically giving you the music and then you've got to take the music. And when you go back to your office, you've got to write the lyrics. But Lee Candiotti's pointed out that actually the music gets written normally after the lyrics. So it's just the opposite way around. The person on stage is giving you the lyrics and you've got to then put the music to it.
Yeah, I think maybe there's also an element where the delegates have got to have an action plan as well, don't they? So it's not all on the speaker. It's also on the to your point when you first mentioned it, Adam. Maybe it's about the psychology of going to an event. Don't just turn up and expect to be entertained. You've got to go out there with some sort of ability to process information and translate it into an actionable point. So maybe that's a training point that, you know, all of us could get better at as well. Katrina, I know you got to go, don't you? You got a plane to catch, is that right? I mean, when are you?
I think if I sit here much longer, I'm going to be your first ever guest to get second degree sunburn live on camera.
Right. So as much as I'd like to see, I don't want to see that. I want your
Irish
perfectly
skin
preserved.
And Florida sunshine are not a good combination.
Yeah. No. Indeed. Absolutely not.
So are you flying back to the UK after this?
Literally. We've got 1 hour and then we've got to go get ourselves dressed and head to the airport.
Yep. Cool. Listen.
With 3 kids, you've got to add an extra hour to your timings for everything, right?
Indeed. So is that including the husband or is that?
He's pretty helpful. He's pretty helpful.
Okay. Fantastic. Well, listen, Katrina, thanks for taking time out in your holiday to have a chat with us. Been great to have you on the show. We'll definitely get you back at some other point because you got so much to share about your experience working in this industry. So have a safe flight. Drop me a line when you're back in town. I'd love to have coffee.
Will do. See you then.
Bye, Kat.
Bye.
She's great, huh? Yeah. I'm a big fan of Katrina, and she's got a new business. I'm quite keen to see how she gets on with that. It's also quite an emerging space where we're seeing a lot of these very experienced, incredible people decide, no, I don't want to work as an employee anymore. They're moving into this high-value, I wouldn't say gig because they're not platform workers, but they are working project to project, choosing a much more financially inconsistent kind of way of working. But I think that's probably pointing to a future that many of us want to embrace because it gives us so much more. You know, she can spend 3 weeks with a family on holiday in Florida at the same time, you know, deliver some work and value while she's out there. So amazing stuff.
It's not for everybody, but think about, like, 10 years ago, you, me, and Kat were all working for other people, and actually none of us do now.
And none of us are doing what?
We were all working for other people 10 years ago, and we're not now.
Yeah. I mean,
it's pretty normal.
It is normal, but it's going to get more, I think, even more so now. I mean, Kat's got family, right? I mean, I made my move when I was a single dude with no sort of responsibilities anywhere else. Whereas she's got three kids, and she's making this sort of a decision at the point when she's already got these obligations. So I think it's getting easier to set up. It's getting easier to deliver value. If you check out a guy called Ronald Coase, I don't know whether you know this name, but he's an economist that basically wrote in the 1930s about the, you know, he asked the question, why do companies exist? Why aren't we all just like networks of freelancers delivering our work? Why is this kind of middleman getting the work and paying us a salary? And you know what his answer was after his research? It was because it's very difficult for a single freelancer to consistently acquire customers. This is in the 1930s. You can't create brands, whereas a company can accrue brand value over time, accrue the supplier relationships, accrue the market capital, etc., and then eventually be able to be much more stable. But global web changes that. I think
people don't want the stress. There's too much stress. I mean, most people don't want that. So that's one of the reasons why I can't see us going towards a world where everybody is freelance. People don't want the stress of continuing to work out where their next gig's going to come from, and are they going to be able to pay their mortgage next month? It creates massive problems in so many different ways. But I do remember when I first started in recruitment, I interviewed a contractor, and he left permanent work about a year before. He'd done three contracts in the previous year. And I remember him saying to me, this is in 1999, I remember saying to me, I don't understand why anybody would work in a permanent job when you can learn so much from going in different companies and doing different things. And I did find that quite interesting.
I'm going to disagree with you and with Steve Rothberg there, who's talked about, you know, what most people want, the security of a permanent work. I'd just challenge whether there is such a thing as that type of security. Like, for instance, this week, who's in the news? IBM for their kind of staff turnover policy. You know, they sacked about 100,000 people. They're getting litigated for ageism. Now, a lot of those people that were sacked or were let go probably thought they had a job for life with IBM. And now they find themselves on the market, 25-year, people call them a lifer in IBM. Are they going to get jobs that easily? Probably not. So I think that the guy you were talking about in the 1990s that you met, the contractor, probably was aware that his market value, his market security wasn't associated necessarily with a permanent contract, but with his skills development and with his network development. So yeah, I think that security is going to come in a different way. It's going to be hyper network. People are going to win it. And people who I think, you know, clock in, clock out and rely on the stability of their employer. I don't know. That's probably not a great strategy. Anyway, we are running fast over time. Jacek, I know you're here and you want to come on, but I'm not sure we have time to bring you on. I do beg your pardon, my friend. But I think we are running over already for time. I just want to say thank you for everyone for showing up to Brain Food Live on air. I hope you enjoyed the show. We are going to create this as an audio cast as well and get that out on podcast. So you can follow that as an audio thing as well. We'll be back next week. Next week we have another show. We've got a bunch of them actually lined up. We need to get better at doing our content scheduling. But just to give you an idea what we're doing, we're going to be talking to Tim Sackett about blue collar work, mass volume. So let's forget about LinkedIn for a moment. How do you hire a bunch of people that are going to do engineering, like real engineering, not software stuff? We're going to be talking about podcasting. So we've got the Chad and Cheese Boys, we've got Matt Alder, we've got all those cool guys that are going to join us to talk about how to create a recruitment podcast.
That's
going to be superb. That's going to be in a couple of weeks' time.
Yeah.
So I'm just giving you a little bit of an idea as to who we've got lined up. And next week, we actually have an empty slot. So if anybody's got any ideas as to what we should put in there, please do. I'm tempted to talk about the ageism side.
When's the empty slot?
The empty slot's next week. Which is the 9th of August. Unless you tell me there's something there, I don't know.
No, there's not. I'm not here on the 16th, but...
Okay.
Can we not bring Tim forward a week?
Tim Kahn, he's on the 27th. So you're back for then, right? So
I'm back for then.
So you're going to miss the podcast one, which is all right. I'll get one of the lads who podcast to do the stand-in. But next week, maybe we do ageism.
Why don't we bring Jacek on and talk about something Jacek wants to talk about, because I think he's been very patient and wanting to get on here.
He has, and Jacek has got a topic to talk about. Yeah, you ping it in there, we'll do it. But next week, come and join us again. Follow the channel and you get notified to the new thing. Hope you've enjoyed the show, folks. This is us signing out.
Cheers, everybody.